It's a real shame, of course, when a language mm-hmm. dies. There's estimates ranging from anywhere from, in Australia, they think there were 250 languages at the time of contact, and they mm-hmm. think that very few of them are going to survive in the long term. Mm-hmm. And worldwide, of course, that's also, the predictions are pretty dire in terms of non-dominant languages, of how many will survive in the long term. Right. And it's really unnecessary for those languages to die. That's my own view, especially now that we have a much better understanding of how children learn language and how they can process language and learn two languages or more at one time. Mm-hmm. It seems to me very unnecessary that those languages die, and also because often the reason that they die is because the people who speak them have been oppressed in some way.
I see.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's very unfortunate with how languages die out like that, right? So what was your research based on, actually? Can
Most
you tell us
of
more?
The research that I've done has been based on the Pomeranian language family, which is the largest language family in Australia. It takes up geographically and in terms of the number of languages. It's the largest family. Mm-hmm. And so my supervisor, that was his main area of study, so I kind of followed along in his footsteps. And for a lot of my research, I've kind of looked at large number of languages and using what's called the comparative method, which is comparing words in those modern languages to try and reconstruct what they used to sound like. In Australia, there are theories about how the languages are related to each other, and mm-hmm. so work is being done now to kind of fine-tune those theories, and so my work was part of that. Cool. And I'm still interested in doing that. I also did some lexicography projects with Jeff O'Grady on some of his data. He had tons and tons of data from a language called Nyangamata, because he actually lived with the Nyangamata people for quite a long time. He was a jackaroo
cool.
on their sheep station.
A jackaroo?
Before
wow.
he was a linguist, he answered an ad in the paper for jackaroos and went mm-hmm. and worked. So that's like a station hand, kind
okay.
of.
Yep.
Worked as a jackaroo on their sheep station, and that's, he learned their language and became fluent in their language.
Wow.
And then went to school and studied linguistics and went back and worked with them. And so he had a lot of data, so I've helped him, or I helped him in organizing some of that data.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, I'm doing a lot of reading on what's called language shift, mm-hmm. and that has to do with what we were talking about the death of languages. So when people speak one language and they live in a community where, say, another language is dominant, so say immigrants to Canada mm-hmm. may choose, for reasons either voluntary or involuntary, not to speak that language and not to pass their heritage language on to their children.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have enough people doing that and the language is small enough, the number of speakers is small enough to start with, that really can endanger the language, right? That's
right.
One of the main causes of language death, is that the language is not being passed on to the children.
Mm-hmm.
So because I'm also a librarian and a writer, mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out a way to intertwine those and create some educational pieces for parents, because it's really parents who make that decision.
Right.
And so they have a lot of power, really, in how, whether or not their language gets transmitted to their children. Mm-hmm. So I'm, as a librarian, of course, I like to collect resources and give people information. So I'm trying to come up with some pieces for parents, and perhaps also school librarians, of how they can support parents in helping their children to learn both languages, because it's entirely possible for children to do that. They have great brains for learning language, and there's no reason why they have to give up their family's heritage language in order to also be fluent in the language of the society that they're living in.
That's right. Well, I remember in class you were saying about how, you know, your grandma, I believe, was Dutch, and but she had the same idea, right? You know,
yeah.
you've got to learn that language of the society, right?
Right.
The country. So she decided that her children would not learn Dutch.
That's right. So my grandparents immigrated to Canada from the Netherlands in the 30s,
right.
late 20s or early 30s,
okay.
and lived up north for a few years, where my mother and her brother did speak Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And when they moved to Vancouver, my grandparents decided that they needed to assimilate completely to the English society mm-hmm. and speak only English. And from that point on, they spoke only English. And that was a very common view at the time.
Right.
And it is very common even still. And so my mother and her brother lost their ability to speak Dutch. And it's very sad because then my mother didn't have the choice of whether or not she was going to pass Dutch on to her children.
Right.
And we've all been very annoyed ever since over this decision that my grandparents made, which was, at the time they thought was the best decision.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really an unnecessary decision because children can operate in two different languages. And they don't need to give up one language in order to speak the other.
That's right. Well, I guess since you're a parent as well, would mm-hmm. you want your children to learn more than one language?
I would have if we had had that option. My husband and I both speak only English, mm-hmm. so we didn't have the option of giving them the gift of another language at home. We have friends though who have done that. You know, being in a university environment, we know a lot of people from a lot of places. And children we know who have grown up speaking, say, Italian and English,
mm-hmm.
there are times when it was a little more difficult for them when they were little, but they soon catch up. And they now have this ability to speak two languages, which can only be a benefit to them in the future.
Well, and I guess one more question related to this area would be, do you think this problem is still prevalent today, or is it not?
I think it's still very prevalent today, mm-hmm. and I think part of it is that parents don't realize that their children are capable of this, and they think they're making the best decision for their children
mm-hmm.
By having them speak only in English, or they don't see the point,
mm-hmm.
Especially you might see this in some languages that are that don't have a lot of power in the world,
yeah.
right? Why should I teach my child this language? What mm-hmm. what benefit is it going to be? But just the exercise of being able to use two languages is, of course, you know, that's good for your brain.
Right.
And it helps to keep that language going.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's also cultural and emotional and family issues that there's benefits to having that connection.
Okay, I see. Yeah, well, though something on my side is that I grew up in a Cantonese-speaking family, and my mom really pressured me into going to a Chinese school uh-huh. because she actually went to a linguistics course, I believe, uh-huh. when she was a student, and her prof was like, you know, learning more than one language is beneficial, and being bilingual is good. Mm-hmm. So she remembered this, and she told me about her story, and that's what made her
mm-hmm.
force me to go and learn Cantonese uh-huh. and use it, and just really incorporate it into
yes.
my life. So at first I really hated it because at school everyone spoke English and it was really hard to communicate with people in like Cantonese, except for my parents at home. And but you know, in the long run, I realized that yeah, you know, you can use Chinese in a lot of areas,
mm-hmm.
especially when you want to joke with your family mm-hmm. or like share things together.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was. I'm really glad that I learned Cantonese. And also, because I know like the Chinese characters, it made learning Japanese a lot easier for
right.
me. So now I speak three-ish languages.
Right, and yes. And it's a benefit. Yeah. It's a benefit
right.
if you travel. It's a benefit perhaps for employment.
Right.
There are a lot of reasons why it's a good thing. I had friends when I was in high school who had to go to German school every Saturday and they hated it. But now as adults, they realize the value of it. But that's
mm-hmm.
that's a struggle too, is that the children may not see a point.
Right.
And so maybe if you can educate them from a young age of why it's a good thing for them to learn another language, they might be more receptive to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. I guess a huge idea in historical linguistics is this argument about there being one proto-language, which is mm-hmm. the mother language of all languages in the world. And some people say there is, some people say there aren't. Which side are you on, Susan?
Well, so there's been a lot of effort and debate over reconstructing or trying to figure out if there was one mother language, which some people call proto-world.
Mm-hmm.
And this debate really exploded in the 90s. There were some very controversial ideas put forward about how the languages of the world are related. On one side, some people think, well, language is such a complicated thing that it's unlikely that it arose independently in different areas of the world. It probably arose once and then spread as people spread. Other people think that maybe language did arise more than once. It's difficult to work back that far. Our tools can take us back several thousand years,
mm-hmm.
but languages change so much that their relationships get obscured.
Mm-hmm.
So my own feeling is, I think it's probably likely that there was a proto-world,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think we're ever going to know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And even, if, you know, we'll all have different theories about it, but our tools really can't take us there with any confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe in thousands and thousands of years, maybe. We might see something.
We might, and with, you know, computer technology helping us out, you never know.
Right.
But given the tools that we have now, I don't know if we can answer that question confidently.
Okay. Yeah. On our first day of class, Susan asked our class why people were so afraid of language change, and our whole class came up with a lot of answers. And what is your view on it?
Well, I see this both as a linguist and as an editor. Some people really do not like language change. They feel there's a proper way to do things and an improper way to do things. And of course, they see themselves for the most part using the proper way.
Mm-hmm.
I did ask that question in the first class, and it led to a lot of discussion. And then we talked about it on the Vista board, mm-hmm. of what were people's pet peeves or what do you know annoys the people that you know, and there was, I don't know, almost 200 answers in that thread, which was quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
People have very strong opinions about language. It's, I think in some ways people feel a real sense of ownership of language.
Mm-hmm.
And also people sometimes feel intimidated by language as well, and they want to be doing it properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't like to see what they think of as improper use of language. Although, of course, how we speak and how we write are two different things, and we, nobody speaks in formal, standard, written English. People end their clauses with prepositions all the time. They split their infinitives because those rules are really kind of artificial for English. So, but people have very strong ideas. Some people try to control how languages change. So we see this in English in the 18th century. There were a lot of prescriptivists who... Mm-hmm. who made up these rules, and they were often based on Latin, which was seen as being a more superior, elegant language.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this in some countries, say France has an academy where they try to control how much English or other languages affect French. And then some people really promote language change. They're really out there on the edge, and they're wanting to use all the newest and latest words.
Mm-hmm.
So you see this kind of spread. But for the most part, people do think they know what's correct and what's incorrect. And
mm-hmm.
it's you see this a lot among editors as well.
I see. So I guess you, since you're an editor, do you like cringe when you hear all these mistakes?
I don't myself, because I was a linguist first.
I'm kind of
trained to be descriptive rather than prescriptive.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that there are different forms of language that are useful in different contexts.
Oh, okay.
So when, as an editor, if I'm editing something academic, I will edit it in very formal academic standard English. If I'm editing a novel that's aimed at teenagers, I'm going to edit that in a completely different way, especially the dialogue, say, because
yeah.
spoken language is not like that.
Right.
So there are some editors, and you see this on some discussion boards, who have very black and white ideas of this is right and this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it all depends on the context and the purpose of what is being written.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I tell people I major in linguistics,
mm-hmm.
they automatically assume I can speak several languages.
Yes.
And that I guess that has happened for
yes.
to you too. Like, why do you think people do that? I have that impression.
Well, for one thing, people do tend to use the word linguist to mean somebody who speaks a lot of languages, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that is an alternative meaning to the word. They think that when we study how a language works, we're learning how to speak that language, which is not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's often the case that you do come to learn the language. But in my case, say in historical linguistics, I'm working with word lists or dictionaries from several different languages, and
mm-hmm.
I may learn some of the vocabulary, but I don't actually learn how to speak those languages. I don't learn the grammar
mm-hmm.
and all of those intricacies. People have very different reactions. Some people find it very interesting, the thought of linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't understand why you would want to study this.
Right.
I think they think back to their high school grammar courses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to study this? And then
mm-hmm.
when I tell them, oh, I study Australian Aboriginal languages here in Canada,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, they don't quite understand why I would want to do that.
Right. And you're getting paid for it too, right?
Yes, that's right.
Like, you're getting paid for doing something that's dying out,
yeah.
right?
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
I've actually taken a lot of linguistics courses in UBC as well. You know, syntax, phonology,
mm-hmm.
phonetics, especially the syntax. I'm thinking, why would people want to study this? Or like, why would people want to do a PhD in this, right?
Yes.
But I mean, I guess like once you really passionate or really into something, then you just want to go for it.
You want to learn about it for its own sake. Mm-hmm. And then the knowledge, you know, it just builds our body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And you never know how that could spill over into other areas. Mm-hmm. I know that there we were in Victoria studying these Australian Aboriginal languages. And at one point, the art gallery in Victoria was having an exhibit of Australian Aboriginal art, and they brought over several artists. It was, I don't know, about 8 or 10 artists came to Canada. And because of our work, Jeff O'Grady and I were involved in welcoming them and arranged a dinner for them and did some things with these artists. And some of them were quite young, and they had never been away from home ever. They hadn't even really been out of their own area. So it was a huge thing for them to come to Canada. Mm-hmm. And pretty much the first thing that they heard was Jeff greeting them. It was one group of them in particular. He greeted them in their own language.
Wow.
And they were so amazed. They were amazed. And we told them about the kind of stuff that we did and that, you know, showed them that there were all these papers written about these languages. And these are people who have been told by society that their languages are primitive, that they are not of value. You know, they lived in a society where years ago, similar to the residential school system here, they were not allowed to speak their languages. Mm-hmm. So they may not see the point of their language, or they may be ashamed, or they may use their language but feel that they're inferior because they're not using English. So for them to come here and to realize that we spent our days studying their languages, they that night called home, the first night they were here, and the first thing they talked about was, you would not believe there are people here studying our languages. Mm-hmm. So it was a source of great pride for them, and you know, to me, that's a very important thing.
Yeah, right. And also, I guess it gives new hope for really preserving these languages.
Yes, to see the value in them. Yeah. They're a value of themselves. They encode all sorts of cultural and historical information. Mm-hmm. To linguists, it's very sad when a language dies because all languages are different. And so you're losing some of that diversity, and you may be losing knowledge of something that other languages don't possess, right? So mm-hmm. that's from a theoretical point of view, in terms of what we want to know about language in general, it's very sad when a language dies. Mm-hmm. But for me, I also think that languages really are, they belong to groups of speakers. And if a language dies because a group of speakers is either forced to give up their language or feels they have to give up their language because it's not good, that's very sad.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That is. You talked about how when we lose language, we lose a lot about the culture, the behaviors, a lot of things. But the thing is, with languages today, a lot of them contain borrowings from the, mm-hmm. I guess, previously the disappeared languages. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's still some hope in really learning about the languages that have gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
By tracing back.
Yeah. So there may be information in neighboring languages,
right.
Borrowed information. We do, in some cases, have records from, say in the case of unwritten languages, we may have some records from explorers or missionaries. And then for some of languages, say in Europe, we do have long histories of written records, and people may also write about other people's languages, so we may have information there. And there is the case, you know, languages that are on the brink of extinction can mm-hmm. be revitalized.
Right.
We see this with varying degrees of success around the world. Mm-hmm. Hebrew is an example, which was, you know, it was not, there's arguments over whether you really should call it dead because it was still used as a written and religious language, mm-hmm. but as a spoken language was not really used anymore. But then with the formation of Israel, then Hebrew was basically revitalized. We see it with some of the Celtic languages. There are efforts to revitalize those. So it is important to have the knowledge of the language because that does give future generations that option. If we can record as much as possible of the languages that are dying out now, even if we can't save them now, at least future generations of with that heritage have the option to go back and at least learn something about the languages that their ancestors spoke.
People are mostly interested in how, you know, words come to be,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a part of historical linguistics.
Yeah. Okay.
Could you tell us
okay.
about it?
There's quite a few ways that new words come into the language. Of course, we borrow words mm-hmm. from other languages a lot. We may borrow words because we borrow concepts from them, or we borrow actual physical items from them, and we need words to describe it. So we also may borrow words from another language if for some reason that language has some power over our own. So for example, in the history of English, we have a lot of words from French because at one time the French ruled England, and we have a lot of words from the Norse language because of the Norse rule of England as well. Mm-hmm. So you can borrow words from other languages, but there's also a lot of ways to make new words, and this is kind of the fun part of language. So for example, we may take little bits of words and put them together and create a new word. So the classic example that is given for this is smog, which is smoke and mm-hmm. fog. But that's, you know, we've used that word for so long now that most people don't even wouldn't even realize that it's a blend. Mm-hmm. But we have some that are that kind of come in and then may leave the language. They may not stick around. So some recent ones that have been recorded are flunami. So that came during the H1N1 scare, when H1N1 was spreading around, and that was a blend of flu for influenza, which is itself called a clipping, or mm-hmm. Because we're shortening the word, flu, and tsunami to create a flunami, so an overwhelming number of flu cases. Mm-hmm. Another one is cheapuccino. So that's a cheap cappuccino, mm-hmm. an inexpensive cappuccino, mm-hmm. Especially one from a vending machine. So cheapuccino is another blend. So those are the kind of words that tend to come into the language, and they're around for a little while, and they show the creativity of the speakers, mm-hmm. but they're probably not going to stay.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a trend, right?
It's a trend, yeah.
It comes in and leaves very quickly.
Language use has fads, just mm-hmm. and fashions, just like anything else.
Right.
So another way that we can come up with new words is by actually misinterpreting what we're hearing.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, English borrowed a word from French, cerise, mm-hmm. to mean cherry, and it's a singular in French, right? It means one cherry, and the plural, which also in French sounds cerise, but it does have that S plural marker in the writing. It's no longer pronounced. English speakers analyzed the singular cerise to be the plural.
Oh.
So they thought cerise meant more than one cherry, uh-huh. so therefore the singular, you take the S off, the way we would in English, the singular must be cherry. So we have cherry and cherries.
Wow.
Right, where they misinterpreted mm-hmm. what was going on, and so they came up with that new word. That's called back formation.
Mm-hmm. I guess English borrows a lot of words from French, and they kind of just borrow from each other, right?
They do. They borrow from each other. English is a very borrowing language. It has no problem just taking words from wherever it needs them. Some languages, the speakers are more resistant to borrowing. They want to keep their language very pure.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this, especially if the speakers are trying to protect their language for some reason, if they feel that the language is being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
English doesn't seem to have that problem. And we have borrowed words for new concepts, but we've also borrowed our word for face is a borrowing. One of our pronouns is a borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
So we will borrow just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
English is made up of an immense number of borrowings compared to other languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like, you know, we use all these words every day, but sometimes we don't really think about where they come from.
No,
or like,
we don't.
If it's actually English, right?
Yeah, that's
really
true.
Interesting.
That's true.
Yeah.
And having some knowledge of this kind of thing comes in very handy at parties. Get you something interesting to talk about.
Or make everyone scared of you and like stop
talking
to
you,
right?
That's right.
So thank you, Susan, for taking the time to do this interview. I don't know how many listeners out there know about historical linguistics, but I really hope that this interview will help spark an interest in historical linguistics and as well, I guess, in the field of linguistics in general. Thank you again, Susan.
Thank you, Bianca.